All right, everybody, get off the telephone with your brokers. Close the browser that you're looking at your 401k to see whether you're losing a lot of money. The market can wait. This is the first Political Rewind of 2016, and we're thrilled to be back on the air. It's such an exciting year coming up. We have a great panel assembled in the studio today, a full house, actually, and we'll introduce them in a minute and start talking politics. But I have an announcement that I've been looking forward to making. That I hope is exciting news for you. It is for us, because there is so much happening in politics in Georgia and across the country in 2016. We're expanding Political Rewind to 2 days a week. Starting next week, we will be on the air Wednesdays at 2 o'clock and will continue Fridays at 3. Don't ask me why we're on different times. It's just the way the schedule goes. So, join us Wednesdays at 2. Fridays, we'll still be with you at 3 o'clock. And it's because you have told us how much you like this show. So thank you all for that. All right, enough. Let's talk politics. Jim Galloway is back with us. He's the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And Political Insider is his baby. You read it online every day to get the latest information on what's happening, really, hour to hour in politics. Liz Flowers, who is a Democratic consultant, and the what is the title that you have with the Democratic Caucus in the state Senate?
Executive Director.
Executive Director of the Democratic Caucus in the state Senate. Loretta Lepore is back. She is a Republican consultant. She's been the co-chair of Carly Fiorina's Georgia campaign, and we'll get a chance to talk to her about Carly Fiorina and, of course, all the presidential news. We are very pleased to welcome, for the first time, to the Political Rewind studio, Michael Thurman. Michael Thurman was Georgia's labor commissioner from 1998 to 2010. Before that, he was a legislator, and he was the Democratic candidate for the United States Senate in 2010. Thank you for being here, Michael.
Delighted, Bill. Thanks for the invitation.
And what can we do without Greg Bluestein, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution political reporter? He is covering everything from the legislature to presidential campaigns. And I think you probably lost about 10 pounds since the last time I saw you. You're so busy covering stuff. All right. Let's get right to it. And let's start with some interesting state issues right now. Two stories popped up in the news this week that both, to some extent, relate to the next governor's race, Jim Galloway, which isn't until 2018, but it's never too soon to start plotting the next race, right? And we have two stories. The first is Congressman Lynn Westmoreland yesterday surprised an awful lot of people by saying he was serving his last term in the United States House.
I think he surprised even his close friends on this one.
Yeah.
It was a shock. We caught wind of it maybe just a few minutes before it broke. He was packing it up and after next December he's going to be coming home. Now there was a follow up question, of course. What are you coming home for? And he's been a widely talked about candidate, a Republican candidate for governor, and he says, I'm not ruling that out.
Well, Greg Bluestein, let me get you in the mix on this. I mean, why? I mean, he's had a successful career by many accounts in the U.S. House. I mean, I know that at a certain point you can get tired of doing the same thing year after year. But why else give up that seat unless you're thinking that over the next 2 years you want to get a gubernatorial campaign up and running?
Yeah. And by the way, this is how big of a surprise it was. We were supposed to have beers with one of his top aides that very night. And he sent us an email about an hour before saying, sorry, can't do it anymore. This news, I think, even caught him by surprise. There's a few reasons, but he also has, there's very little reason for him not to say he's thinking about governor too, because of course he wants to stay in the discussion, in the debate. And that's exactly what he's doing here. And also, there's already speculation about who will replace him in that West Georgia seat, which is very Republican.
Well, we'll talk about that in just a second. But Michael Thurman, you served in the House. You were in the legislature when Westmoreland was there, so you must remember working with him.
Oh, yeah. I worked with Lynn over the years, served together in the House, but also worked with him as labor commissioner, DFACS director. And he's always been a really populist kind of guy. He didn't always told a party line, he spoke his mind, and I don't know what his future plans are, but he would be a formidable candidate in a Republican primary, especially in light of the fact that there is this sentiment now for outsiders, for people who don't toe the party line, and non-traditional type candidates.
There's a very tight line to be drawn between Lynn Westmoreland and Nathan Deal, first of all, largely in the person of Brian Robinson, one of our contacts here. He was originally a staffer for Lynn Westmoreland and then shifted over to Nathan Deal during Deal's first campaign. But I think one thing you do have to we've got a fairly toxic situation up in Washington that's not going to get any better after the 2016 election. I think Lynn Westmoreland realized that, and I think he's trying to put some real air between himself and Washington. If David Perdue is the new model of how you win a statewide race, the farther away from Washington you are, the better.
Well, and I was going to just say that, Loretta, because Jim and Michael really are saying something quite similar. Westmoreland wants to now position himself, if he's going to make this race, as kind of an outsider, although after six terms in the House, I'm not sure how well you can do that.
Right. I think there's two considerations. I think on the one hand, he was tired of what's going on in Washington. He was fatigued by it, and he said that on many occasions. So in that respect, we shouldn't be surprised by this move, maybe the timing of it, but not the fact that he's done this. And then I think the governor's race is a separate consideration for him and whether he wants to remain in the political realm. And I think the outcome of what happens with the presidential race coming down the pike and how the state votes in that race in November is going to determine probably and be a factor for him in his decision-making as to whether he would enter a gubernatorial race.
Right. But, Liz, we can assume that that third district seat, Greg mentioned there already is speculation about who might run for that seat. That's a safe Republican seat for the conceivable future, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that, and I don't know when you're going to get to this, but there is some speculation of who might run. And it will, for instance,
go ahead, talk about it.
Josh McCoon's name has been tossed
Senator
around.
Senator Josh McCoon.
And, of course, many know him because of his involvement with the Religious Freedom Act. And he's also been talked about for attorney general. So this shakeup, if you will, for lack of a better term, actually opens up a number of spaces of who might be running in which seat. So it's not just that congressional seat. It also starts to open up some of the seats at the state level.
All right. So our good friend, Todd Rehm of Georgia Pundit, he's done a really interesting, as he does so often, breakdown of the data in the third congressional district. He looks at how many votes are in each of the House districts there to get a sense of where the real power in the district is. We're not going to go into it in detail because we have so much to cover. But for people who are real political geeks, go to georgiapundit.com and read what Todd has to say about it. It's fascinating. So let's look at the other big story that broke this week that also could have an impact on the gubernatorial race. Again, I turn to you, Jim. Governor Deal, of course, issued an executive order saying we are going to stop allowing Syrian refugees into the state. And to make sure people understand that we're serious, we are no longer going to process benefit requests from Syrian refugees who should find their way in the state. Sam Olens, the attorney general, said what?
He said, no, you can't do that. And on Monday, the governor rescinded his order. He backed off. Now, you folks here may disagree with me. My interpretation is that Sam Olens has crossed something of a Rubicon here. It is hard for an attorney general to issue an opinion like this, and it was entirely. The law is clearly on his side. It's morally, it was the right decision. Politically, I think that puts a very large barrier between him and the 2018 race for governor.
Yeah, Liz Olens says, look, I can't find a way to go into court if we're challenged on this and defend the state's position. I think, unfortunately, and he didn't use the word unfortunately, but he said, I don't think we have a leg to stand on if this goes to court. So, you know, the question is, perhaps he was just acting as the state's lawyer, but it does have political implications for him, possibly.
Sure. Everything seems to have some sort of political implication. And I tend to take this for what it is and read it as it's put out. Sam Olens is a fine lawyer, and I believe he made a good legal decision. You know, when all of these, with 20, 30 Republican governors around the country jumped on the Syrian refugee denial bandwagon. You know, some of that is for populist show. And I think when it comes down to it, Sam Olin's job is not for populist show. He's a good lawyer. And I can't imagine that Governor Deal didn't know this was coming and then what the ultimate decision would be. And I know that there's some speculation about moving forward in 18, whether or not Sam Olin wants to run for governor, whether he doesn't. But at the end of it, I think if I'm Sam Olin, I'd rather come out knowing that I did the right legal thing versus, you know, something else that makes me look more political.
Yeah, the other thing we've got coming out of this is the emergence of an independent attorney general. I mean, you've got that's one thing that has been missing.
Wait a second now. Roy Barnes would argue that Thurber Baker was way more independent than he would have liked him to have been when Barnes was governor.
Yeah, but Thurber Baker wasn't and clearly, look, when we have an attorney general in one party and a governor in another party, yeah, that's going to be a natural check on one is going to be a natural check on the other. But under Democratic rule, you had Arthur Bolton and Mike Bowers really kind of stand up to various administrations.
Right.
And this is a first big instance in when that is happening on the Republican side.
I think Liz's point was the correct point, that Sam at the core believes that his job is his job and that first and foremost he must act as attorney general and the political ramifications come second.
All right, so Mike Thurman, is he falling on his sword? Can, in a state that is likely to support either Donald Trump or Ted Cruz this primary year, can a guy who says we got to let Syrian refugees in and we've got to give them benefits, can he be elected in a state that is that far to the right?
Not sure, but to the point, he did the right thing by following the rule of law. Look, this is no surprise to anyone who's followed this issue. It was even in the governor's office and all across this country, it was clear that there was very little legal groundwork to stand on. It was a political statement. What Sam Olin did is what he should have done as our chief legal officer, which is to interpret the law and to mete it out fairly and justly and irrespective as to where the political chips may fall.
Let's not forget how big of a jarring turnabout this was for the governor, though. He as Liz pointed out, more than 30 governors did take sign these similar executive orders, but the governor's was one of a few governors who actually halted the paperwork to process these Syrian refugees, which basically set up a legal showdown. And the governor, all the rhetoric in the weeks leading up to this formal opinion, saying we're ready for that legal showdown. We're ready to spend tax. I wish we didn't have to, but we're ready to spend taxpayer dollars, is what the governor said. So this was a decisive retreat for the governor.
Yeah, but I just want to say this, and no one else will follow my thinking on this, but you know, we also see a story this week where Georgia ranks number 7 in the nation for federal funding. And you can't help but think, if the feds have told you that you as a state, you can't come in and just decide for yourselves what kind of money you're going to take and what other, you know, there are other funds potentially tied to this. And so I think at some point, Olin's, whoever else may have been involved, took a step back and looked at the larger picture, and this was just not the right move for Georgia.
So, Greg, regardless, to put a period on this part of the conversation, regardless of the Sam Olin's decision, the fact that the governor has rescinded his executive order, are we likely to see anything bubble up in the legislature that will at least give lip service, a resolution from someone saying, without regard to the attorney general's opinion, we think it's unsafe for, you know, we think something like that will probably come up?
It's a red meat election year session, so I wouldn't doubt there would be resolutions that might have no meaning to
right,
them.
Right.
But also what we'll be watching is any budget implications that might have for Sam Olin's office. That's what might happen.
All right. In fact, let's turn now to the legislature, because, wow, I mean, this session coming in the middle of a presidential election year where we're already dealing with some very, very interesting and controversial ideas is I think, going to be something. But let's start by saying, Greg Bluestein, maybe the best thing we can say about this session, at least from a journalistic point of view, is that they're telling us it's going to be really short.
right?
Yes, but they always tell us.
Well, yeah, choice. They do. But there seems to be some real, real thinking that they've got to get in and out of there this time.
The betting is right now that crossover day, which is one of the biggest deadlines near the end of the session, would be the first week of March, and that maybe by St. Patrick's Day, the session could be over. I still wouldn't take that bet.
Liz, what do you hear?
Well, I'm hearing exactly the same thing. But to Greg's point is that it's a hard bet to take.
Yeah.
When you're down, the biggest motivation is that sitting elected officials are barred by law from accepting campaign contributions while they are in session. And since we have moved the primary date up in Georgia to May, it is a very short, typically 6-week sprint from when we get out of the legislature to a primary. So they want to get out to be able to raise money for their campaign.
All right. So I'm glad you said that, because this is my public service announcement for the day. Because I've heard a lot of people have asked me questions about all of the races that are on the March 1st primary ballot here. And we should make clear, just in case people don't understand this, that in Georgia, that first primary is strictly a presidential primary. There may be a few municipal elections tacked on, I think, in some areas.
Maybe a special election. Somewhere in there.
But we don't have elections for statewide and for legislative primaries until the end of May.
I believe it's May 24th.
24th. Yeah. Little public service announcement. All right. Jim Galloway, the education reform is one of the issues that people are talking about this year. And the story that's gotten the most play has been Governor Deal suggesting this is the time to have merit pay. Teacher performance should determine pay. That is already
a significant move toward merit pay, I think is what he said.
Okay. That's already causing some significant backlash.
It is. You've already got David Ralston saying he wants to see the specifics and how you are going to define what would merit a pay increase for teachers. You know, we need to get a former state school.
That's right.
DeKalb County school
exactly
superintendent
right.
in on this.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you measure? Do you measure test scores? Is that how you grade improvement, or movement within those test scores? You know, from if you can move a student from D to C, is that the same as moving him from B to A?
Michael, I should have, when I introduced you, pointed out that you were the acting superintendent of DeKalb County Schools. You came in
the superintendent,
and then the superintendent, and you came in when there were so many problems with the system, and you've gotten an enormous amount of credit for the way in which you were able to stabilize things. So to the point that Jim is making, teachers hate the idea of merit pay, right?
Well, to your point about DeKalb, though, we had a great team of people who came together to help to rescue the district. But Jim Galloway really went to the meat of the issue. What is the metric you use to determine who would qualify, become eligible for the merit pay? Let me tell you where education is moving away from. Looking at a static cut score, 60, 50, and then determining whether or not that's success. When you're dealing with a large population of children who may come from homes who are economically disadvantaged, which is the majority of the public school children in the state of Georgia, improving that child, the growth is equally as significant as the achievement. Growth is the essence of achievement. Look, if I'm a teacher and a child is reading at a second grade level in the sixth grade, I move that child 2 grade levels to the fourth grade, even though he or she may not have reached a specific score. That is a magnificent job that should be celebrated and not punished. What is the essence of achievement? It's growing. We have to have a system. And what educators are saying, Dr. McGill at Page, GAE and others. Well, we don't have teachers
unions. I know we
don't
have unions. The teachers' associations.
What they are saying is they're not necessarily opposed to merit pay. The problem is, what metric would you use to determine who would become eligible?
And I think, and this is where the presidential primary really works in here. Yes, voters will only be voting for president on March 1st, but you think of it as a warm-up. You know, you've activated those voters for that year. And that means you're going to have a more active electorate in May with the primaries. And if you get teachers angry during this session, you've got a better chance of them showing up in May.
Yeah.
And one interesting thing about this, the AJC has a poll coming out this Sunday that shows a significant majority of voters in both parties are opposed to the idea of merit pay for teachers.
Well, I think it's interesting that this idea is being put forward, Loretta, by Governor Deal. He's run his last election. Mm-hmm. He's not going to have to face teacher voters again. But your legislators, Liz Flowers, they are. And the question is, can they, in fact, vote for a merit pay bill that might be incredibly controversial? And will that, in fact, put them in real jeopardy with that teacher voting block, which is significant?
Well, not my crew.
Well, no, I understand.
Yes.
I think that while in principle some of the GOP members may like the idea of merit pay and moving toward a merit pay system, I think the reality of that passing in an election year is going to be slim to none. I think there's just not going to be an appetite for them to want to do that. And I think this whole idea of pegging merit pay to testing, and when there's so many variables around testing, and when a speaker comes out and so adamantly says, look, I have to break with the governor on this one. And he was very clear about that. So he's breaking because of his opinion, but he's also breaking because he has to look out for
his
caucus.
He's protecting his members.
He has to look for his caucus.
To Loretta's point, there is a broad consensus on the left and the right, Republican and Democrat, that we are investing too much time and energy in high-stakes testing.
That's right.
The high-stakes testing is tied to the hip to teacher merit pay. People oppose it. Conservatives, many liberals. That is why you saw for the first time the repeal of the No Child Left Behind. It was a rejection of that whole idea that one test or series of tests can evaluate either a child or a teacher or a school.
And yet, Greg, I read in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution that no one is moving towards changing the testing frequency or standards at this point in the legislature.
Yeah, this is what's going to be a very interesting question to watch in the legislative session. What we're hearing is, because of these concerns about metrics and merit pay, that the governor, instead of trying to push one massive overhaul, there's going to be a lot of smaller changes and lots of budgetary changes that will try to start the process of including more. They won't call it merit pay, it'll be quality teacher pay or performance pay or whatever it might be, for the end result of rewarding teachers based on metrics other than their tenure.
All right, while we're with you, are we going to see, in fact, the introduction, which we've been hearing was going to come for a while, but at least if it's out there, I'm not aware of it. Are we going to see a new funding formula actually proposed? Our funding formula for state schools was passed in 1983 or 4. 85, was it that long? So recent. And it's everybody agrees it's been a failure. Poor school systems don't have enough money to do their work. The problem is, how do you distribute more money? That's like a third rail of politics tampering with the funding formula.
Governors have complained about it almost since it was passed. I mean, look back in the archives and I saw complaints starting in 86, 87. Governor Deal in 2013 first said that I will stake my re-election on it. All through the campaign trail, it was the single thing he talked about the most. After his election, he said, well, let's take a giant step back. So it remains to be seen whether or not a QBE overhaul.
Yeah, the crux of this is that QBE was kind of income redistribution before it wasn't cool.
Well, it was.
you took from the wealthy counties, right, and you gave to the poorer,
right,
counties.
Right. If you're Cobb County and you have a property tax base that enriches, that you have plenty of money to work with, and DeKalb County doesn't have that same property tax base, you've got to find a way to distribute those public funds a little more fairly. Right.
I've been around a long time. I came to the legislature in 1986.
There.
That's when I met Bill. I was on the House Education Committee. We were all in an uproar over QBE. But let me tell you what has really happened. And what will happen if it passed the legislature is that for the first time, Georgia will weight students based on their socioeconomic status. Educators know, researchers know, that it's a greater challenge to educate children who come from economically disadvantaged families than not. Georgia has never acknowledged that before.
Mike, the folks who were around when Joe Frank Harris put QBE on the table know that what the governor's people were saying quietly but didn't want to say publicly is they hoped that their measure would eliminate the last vestiges of the old SEG school system in Georgia.
Absolutely. And then, you know, poverty was more or less a rural phenomenon. In the 21st century, now the suburbanization of poverty is impacting school districts, particularly here in metropolitan Atlanta. That's why this new funding formula will have such an impact. We were trying to address a problem that was in rural Georgia. Well, guess what? The grandchildren of those children are now living in metropolitan
Atlanta. And the problem is that you've got these wealthier counties trying to protect their own,
right?
Because now I'm from Cobb County. I pay attention to what my legislative delegation does. They had a nice little meeting with the school board, and the school board's top priority was you cap the amount of money that is drawn from our school system
to send to a poorer school system.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And let me just say real quick, I just want to say this, is that what Michael Thurman's saying is correct, and I think it's going to be the path that gets us there that's going to be debated, because Democrats have introduced community schools, which if we just look at putting some resource folks in, we can begin to address programmatically poverty issues that exist in communities in different ways. So I think it's a philosophical difference of how we get there.
All right, look, we're way overdue for a break, but I want to touch on two other legislative issues very briefly now, because we'll have a lot of time to talk about them in the weeks ahead. Loretta, if this were a movie sequel, Josh McCoon by now would be a multi-gazillionaire. Once again, this year, the Religious Liberty Bill, the RFRA, is back. Why does McCoon think that this is his lucky year, especially since this year, in a way that I don't think they were preparing well in advance of the session in the other last 2 years, the business community is now way out front saying no way.
Right. So I think there's a couple of reasons for that. So the business community had a lot at stake last year with transportation. And so they took a back seat on that issue.
Decided to push transportation instead of RFRA.
Right.
But quietly
made their views known. And that bill was tabled. They did have input there. I think now the business community said, in lieu of what happened in Indiana, and they have done, you know, had the opportunity to do studies. They've had the opportunity to look at the economic impact. They've been able to do polling. So they're bringing with them to the legislature quantifiable data, which they didn't have heretofore.
Oh.
So it's not just an argument any longer based on philosophy. It's an issue now that is real, and there's concrete data to put forward.
Okay, and what's interesting about this, Jim Galloway, is remember, of course, the fight always is that people who oppose this, Democrats and others, Liz, have said, look, this is just a way to discriminate against gays and lesbians and anybody else that people out there don't want to do business with, that government doesn't want to deal with. McCoon always says, no, it only relates to government. But Jim Galloway, we have an even more direct assault on a form of or on protecting religious freedom in a bill that is apparently going to be dropped by Senator Greg Kirk.
Right, of Columbus. Of America's.
America's. Who says?
He says he's taking a model of the Federal First Amendment Defense Act, signed by Johnny Isaacs and David Perdue. But it has not moved in Washington, and probably won't ever move. But what it says is it would prohibit any government sanctions, tax loss of tax breaks, loss of deductible charities by organizations that oppose same-sex marriage.
And would it protect the Kim Davises of Georgia who did not want to issue marriage licenses?
Well, Greg Kirk's version apparently would.
Yes.
He intends to. Now, how far do you extend that protection? Do you extend it to those who issue wedding licenses? If so, do you also extend it to those who issue death certificates? If so, do you give it to the revenue slogs who process joint tax returns?
Liz, it's a direct assault on a Supreme Court decision which paved the way, opened the door for gay marriage across the country.
That's right. And Josh McCoon said repeatedly, publicly at the legislature, that this was not about attacking
his bill, not Greg Kirk's.
Not about LGBT families. In fact, that discussion has now shifted in a huge way to this, what we're calling FATA, the First Amendment Defense Act. And it is a full attack on our LGBT families.
All right, well, go ahead.
And so we're going to see those caucuses out in force, along with the business community, who, to Loretta's point, now has financial data that shows that Georgia would lose, just in the first week on convention business, $600 million.
All right. Senator Greg Kirk is going to be with us for the first edition of Lawmakers, which comes back to GPB. WBB television on Monday night at 7 o'clock. It'll be interesting to hear him lay this out. Look, we have got to take a break. You're listening to Political Rewind. It's 3:35 in the afternoon, and we've got an hour's worth of politics to cram into the last 20 or so minutes of the show. We'll be right back.
GPB invites you to join us this Wednesday morning at 11 for our broadcast of the annual State of the State Address live from Atlanta. Governor Nathan Deal presents his assessment of the past year in Georgia and his plans for the coming year. So please join us this Wednesday morning at 11 for the broadcast of the Governor's State of the State Address. You can also see the address live on our website, gpb.org. You're listening to Political Rewind with Bill Nigut here on Georgia Public Broadcasting, an 18-station radio network. Thank you for joining us. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, collaborating with universities in China, Korea, Turkey, Brazil, and South Africa.
Oh, Canada, our home and native land.
No one in this studio here at Political Rewind is standing up for the Canadian National Anthem, but perhaps Ted Cruz is somewhere. I don't know what to even begin to say as we start our presidential conversation about this fight that has developed over whether Ted Cruz is really qualifies to be president. Greg Bluestein, he was born in Canada to an American mother, and suddenly there are interesting questions being raised, which from my point of view simply suggests that the guy has really got momentum. Let's listen to what Donald Trump very coyly said the other day.
I hope it's not the case. I hope that's not going to be a problem for him. But I've been hearing a lot about it, and you've been hearing, and I guess everybody's talking about it now that he's doing better. And I think that they are looking at it, and it's a problem for him, and it's a problem obviously for the Republicans, because if the Democrats, let's assume he got a nomination and the Democrats bring suit, the suit takes 2 to 3 years to solve. So how do you run?
Greg, Trump doesn't want to suggest it's a huge problem.
No, I'm not saying. I'm just saying.
Yeah, right. Like, who knew he could do subtle or passive aggressive?
I mean, birtherism is back. And clearly this is an indication. Cruz is leading Trump in the polls in Iowa. He's building his ground game down in the South for the March for South Carolina and the March 1st primaries in Georgia, Texas, and everywhere else. And it's going to be it seems like it's going to definitely be a showdown between the two down here.
And Mike, that's why I wanted to bring it up, because as silly as it might be, although there are some people who think there might be some real constitutional matters at stake. For instance, let's listen to what Ted Cruz's good friend John McCain had to say about this.
I do not know the answer to that. I know it came up in my race because I was born in Panama, but I was born in the Canal Zone, which is a territory. Barry Goldwater was born in Arizona when it was a territory. Mm-hmm. When he ran in 1964.
But you were born on
Supreme
a base,
Court.
Too, weren't you?
Yeah, it was
okay.
It's a U.S. military base.
Yeah.
That's different from being born on foreign soil. So I think there is a question. I am not a constitutional scholar on that, but I think it's worth looking into.
Mike, the people who don't like Ted Cruz are having a field day with this. And John McCain and Ted Cruz have been enemies in the United States Senate almost from the day Cruz got there.
Yeah, well, the issue has not been litigated in the highest courts of our land. Let's just say that. So at some levels, it is a legal issue, not one for me. The most interesting thing in the Trump comment was that he said it might be a problem for the Republicans.
Yeah.
Which didn't include himself. Oh. I mean, it was really, if you had to listen very carefully to what he said, he couched it as a problem for the Republicans, not for himself. And what we're witnessing, I think, is a blood feud for the soul of the Republican Party that will play itself out through the primary all the way to the convention. And as a lifelong Democrat, get your popcorn out. Right?
I will tell you, it was a popcorn moment when you saw, you know, I mean, during this whole is Obama an American citizen or not argument, you would go to every Republican in Congress and ask them, do they believe, is Obama a proper citizen? Well, I don't, you know, kind of look at it, kind of. And this week, Nancy Pelosi, the minority leader in Congress, was asked if Ted Cruz is a real citizen. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And she said, well, I don't know.
Loretta, look.
The White House is having a field day with this.
Of course they are. Josh Earnest is enjoying his press briefings more than he ever has before. But Loretta, let me go back to what I said earlier. this wouldn't even be, even if it's not serious, everybody's now looking for ammunition. It just shows that Ted Cruz is on the move, doesn't it?
Well, he's clearly on the move. I mean, you can see his popularity ratings. Yeah. You can see the polled numbers that he's moving up and taking over in Iowa and so forth. He does have a groundswell of support in the Southeast. He always has. But he's also being called on the carpet on a number of issues by his opponents. And he's getting knocked around a little bit. And how he handles this pressure being under this type of spotlight where these folks are teed up, ready to go after him. And we've got some real street fighters in the Republican race. Ted Cruz is, well, he's intellectually superior to most in the political realm. He's not a street fighter. So it's going to be interesting to see how he sustains a lot of these hits he's going to take. And next week on the debate stage, it's going to be brutal.
Yeah,
you've got a lot of Republicans who think that Ted Cruz atop a Republican ticket is just as dangerous as Donald Trump when it comes to threatening the Republican majority in the Senate. And it wouldn't surprise me if I know John McCain is one of those. And that's why you see people starting to talk about, oh, how do we get this establishment express lane fixed? And, you know, is it Rubio? Is it Kasich? Is it still Jeb Bush?
Loretta, we want to give you an opportunity, given your involvement with the Fiorina campaign. Mm-hmm. What's her lane? She has faded a bit from the media coverage of the race. What's her path forward?
Well, I mean, I think if you were to ask anybody on the campaign, they would say, in short, that it's to exceed expectations in advance. So they've always known this is going to be a long road for her, and that it's going to be through attrition of the other candidates that she's going to pick up support. Now, she's got one of the lowest burn rates in this race. You can look at Jeb Bush, who's spending over $50 million. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's up there in the million-dollar range every day, spending money on advertising and not moving. On the other hand, Carly, who's not getting national attention, she's on the national news every day, but when they're showing pictures and so forth, they're not putting her picture up. She has the highest favorability ratings in New Hampshire. That poll just came out yesterday.
Is she running for vice president? The question's been asked from the start, but now it seems more pertinent than it did, say, 3 or 4 months ago when she was a real darling in her early appearances.
You know, I would say that that's an interesting question at this juncture, because when this race began and I was out talking with people and attending meetings and so forth, that was more of a prevailing question. Now she's being taken very seriously as a presidential candidate. They don't ask me questions about her being a vice presidential candidate. And I think that's an interesting twist. While the media may be going there, and not the media in these early states, they take her very seriously. And they can see the ground game in these states. And they know her ground game is robust, it's big, it's mobile, it's moving. You have, you know, John Kasich pointed out this week that, you know, Donald Trump may draw 5,000 people to a rally, but he can only get 50 people in a room for an organizing meeting. Carly's got 500 people on the ground in New Hampshire. So these early states are so unique compared to what's going on in the rest of the country. And the national, what's being reported nationally and what's happening on the ground, most of the candidates in this race will tell you there is a huge schism.
Yeah. Jim, you want to jump in?
Well, I would say, number one, I agree with Loretta on the shift of attitude toward Carly Fiorina. And I think one cause of that is the fact that the establishment candidate, the race for that lane has become so fluid. They don't know who it is, and it could very well end up being Carly Fiorina. I will tell you one thing that we haven't talked about is before we adjourned last in December, you know, Ben Carson was still a legitimate candidate.
Right. That's right.
And yesterday he was in Iowa. He was talking to a group of high schoolers. He asked them or students. He asked them to identify these fifth graders to identify the worst student in their class, which they did.
Ooh.
They pointed the young man out.
Oh, that's
and
sad.
It became one of these just cringe moments, and nobody noticed.
Because no coverage.
Because Ben Carson isn't being considered a serious candidate.
Greg, I want to pick up on something Loretta said, because you're doing some traveling out there, and I traveled all the time back when I was still a younger man. it is true that we don't see the ground game when we're covering races from a place like Atlanta or whatever. And right now, it's the ground game in Iowa, and it's the ground game in New Hampshire, and then in South Carolina, and eventually Georgia, that have a lot more impact than anything we might talk about in terms of the sound bites of the candidates and even the polls, right?
I mean, those first two contests, Iowa, February 1st, and New Hampshire about a week later, they're going to reset the table. They're going to reset the national polls. They're going to rejigger this entire contest, and we're going to have an entirely different race no matter what happens. Even if Trump wins the first two, which is considered somewhat unlikely, it's going to be a different race by the time it gets to South Carolina and Georgia.
All right, let's get another quick break in and then come back, and we'll talk more presidential politics. It's 3:46. This is Political Rewind.
If Homeland Security has its way, soon residents of some states might need a form of ID other than a driver's license to get on a plane. That is, unless those states make changes.
If you start turning away people at airports because their state legislature has a different policy on driver's licenses than the federal government wants, you'd see bedlam in the country.
The issue of real IDs, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 till 7 on GPB.
We're back on Political Rewind. With me in the studio today, Greg Bluestein of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Michael Thurmond, former labor commissioner, superintendent of the DeKalb County Schools, Democratic candidate for United States Senate, his first appearance, Loretta Lepore, a Republican political consultant and co-chair of the Carly Fiorina campaign here in Georgia, Liz Flowers, who is the executive director of the Democratic Caucus at the Georgia State Senate and a Democratic consultant, and our friend Jim Galloway, the political writer for the AJC. So we're talking about who's coming out we've got Iowa caucus February 1st, New Hampshire votes Tuesday, February 8th, and then South Carolina is, I think, the 23rd. It's a Saturday. I don't have my calendar in front of me, but South Carolina votes toward the end of February before they turn here.
South Carolina votes on, I believe, Saturday. If it's not, I think it's February 28th.
28th.
And then Georgia votes the next Tuesday.
March 1st. All right. So let's speculate. So we've got we know Trump and Cruz are coming out one way or the other. Who knows who's in first at that point. Christie, Rubio, Fiorina, Bush. Rand Paul? Are we likely to see somebody? Are we going to see dropouts come up after New Hampshire?
There's kind of two schools of thought. There's one that says, yeah, inevitably, because people won't be able to, hoard their campaign cash and continue to run a campaign. But then there's the Newt Gingrich school of thought, which is what he said, which is, why would you drop out? If you can even control one or two delegates, if you can have any sort of sway in what could be a brokered convention, then why would you lose it?
I think also, Bill, we have to consider that the Republican national leaders changed how they will elect their nominee. And consequently, you can win, but it will be a caveat.
Up until March 15th,
yes,
every state that votes in the Republican primary, it's proportional. It's not nobody. There's no winner take all
largely based on congressional district.
Absolutely, and that may allow the second, third, and even fourth place finishers to remain viable in the race at least through the 15th.
Is that how you see it, Loretta?
That's why I was alluding to the fact that you have to prepare for the long haul, and a candidate like Carly is, being disciplined, both in terms of where you spend your time and energies, as well as your financial resources, preparing for the long game, because you can pick up one or two delegates in the Northeast or in Iowa and come into the South, pick up a few more and keep going. Half the states will have voted by March 15th.
Let's talk about a couple of the Republican candidates right now. And we're emphasizing Republicans because that's where the big, big race is. Right now, Hillary Clinton has a significant lead over Bernie Sanders. And if that starts changing, we'll talk more about it. But let's keep on the Republican side for the time. Liz Flowers, let's listen to what Chris Christie had to say in a veiled way about Donald Trump the other day. And let's talk about whether you think he's gaining any momentum.
Showtime is over, everybody. We are not electing an entertainer in chief. Showmanship is fun, but it's not the kind of leadership that'll truly change America. If we're going to turn our frustration and anger with the DC insiders, the politicians of yesterday, and the carnival barkers of today into something that actually will change American lives for the better, we must elect someone who has been tested.
Liz?
Wow.
What do you think?
You know, I was actually trying to think about what I would say about Donald Trump in general that either hasn't already been said or what. I mean, all of what you just talked about in terms of how things play out, as we all know, there is a lot of time left for anything to happen. And I think at the end of this, most political operatives are asking themselves and each other the same question. Can Trump turn his voters out? Because the machines that are in place by the people who would be considered establishment candidates know how to do that. Donald Trump has never done that before. He does draw big crowds. I would actually put him in the show barkers category. And then you wonder, is that show, can he turn people out to
all
vote?
Right. So how do you like the way Chris Christie sounded there, though, Michael Thurman?
I think he sounded very credible. And see, this thing is really, I think voters are just now beginning to really pay attention. And I think, unfortunately, this whole idea of winning, Donald Trump is a brilliant salesman. And he's pitched this thing that I'm winning. Well, winning is defined totally different in a Republican primary than what he has articulated to the general public.
I tell you, one thing that might be more interesting than what Chris Christie said about Donald Trump was what Chris Christie said about Marco Rubio.
Oh, well, you know what? Oh. We don't have. Go ahead and talk about that.
What did he say? I missed that, Bill.
We have establishment candidates going after each other now.
That's what I was going to get
set up. And this is Chris Christie saying that Hillary Clinton will pat Marco Rubio on the head and then cut his heart out.
And then Marco Rubio's Super PAC released this commercial.
Chris Christie could well be Obama's favorite Republican governor. Why? Christie's record. He instituted an internet sales tax, supported Common Core, and liberal energy policies. Incredibly, Christie even backed Obamacare's Medicaid expansion. Chris Christie, one high-tax, Common Core, liberal energy-loving, Obamacare Medicaid-expanding president, is enough. Conservative Solutions PAC is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Holy cow.
It's great. I mean, Loretta, we're seeing Rubio, Christie, we're seeing Trump, Cruz. I mean, this thing is really starting to turn into a dogfight among specific candidates.
It really is. And Chris Christie came out today with an ad rebutting that, which essentially the whole ad is just a quote from Marco Rubio praising Chris Christie for being elected as the conservative candidate in New Jersey. And so they're all going at one another. And it's just going to get very unpleasant for the voters in New Hampshire and Iowa in the next coming weeks.
The chronology of the race, though, is really tough for Christie after New Hampshire. And this tells a story. The AJC poll that's coming out Sunday shows that Trump, Cruz, Rubio, Carson all have about 60% favorability ratings among Republicans. You ask about Christie and Bush, 50% unfavorability ratings.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
I know, Bill, we're not talking about Hillary and
you
Sanders.
You can talk about it right now.
But I see some, if you look at the Sanders campaign and the Trump campaign, they are mirror images, but in totally different voting segments.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There are people who are angry and frustrated. Yes. Primarily all white voters who are frustrated primarily with the economy and are angry that elected officials have not addressed the key fundamental issues, which is what can we do to help the middle class?
Well, you make an interesting comment, and Liz, I'll bring you in on this, because all of a sudden we're seeing that. We're seeing Sanders start to sort of, there's a synergy all of a sudden between him and Trump over this very thing.
Right. And so we talked about first about the turnout issue. I think the other big thing to keep our eye on in this election cycle is, will the populist candidate and the populist message resonate with enough voters to change it? And I think, Greg Bluestein, you had a piece. I saw a quote from a woman in South Carolina, a 63-year-old woman who said she had never voted in her life, but was turning out to vote for Donald Trump. You see that same sort of thing happening with Bernie on the left with Bernie Sanders. The question is that are they fed up enough actually to pursue to the end that populist argument? And the other piece of that on the turnout is, like, I don't know if she's actually knows that even if she's not voted, she's not necessarily registered to vote. Are they going to be able to register those people with a machine and turn those folks out to vote? And I think that's what we have to keep our eye on.
Well, one of the other interesting phenomenons with both of those candidates is on college campuses. They are like, you know, icons. It's like Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, and the kids, you know, debate which one is more extreme. And but that's where they're gravitating. Right. They're not going to the mainstream candidates because they're intrigued and it's their first entree into the political or presidential election. And I find that to be very interesting. I mean, I don't think many of them are going to be voting because they're going to be on spring break. But it's a evolution of the next generation
of
voters coming
up. I think it matters more on the Republican side than on the Democratic side. I think if there is a silver lining to Donald Trump's candidacy for Republicans is that he's really severing the ideological ties that have kind of constrained the Republican Party over the last, say, 10, 20 years.
Absolutely.
I would say ideological, and I would also say the lack of the, and this is the one thing I will be very partisan on, the lack of the Republicans to address middle class and working class issues in favor of Wall Street and big business, because that's the populist crew that you're seeing from the right bubble up because they are finally realizing things have not changed for them and they won't get better.
All right, Mike, you brought this up and you're going to have about 30 seconds if you don't mind to respond to it. Look, you draw the parallel between Trump and Bernie Sanders. Sanders has raised almost as much money in the last cycle as Hillary Clinton did, and yet he hasn't been able to really bring his numbers up, except in New Hampshire, to be really, really considered competitive with her. Why not?
Well, we've not gone into the caucuses yet. Same issue. That's why Secretary Clinton's staff is working so hard. And I'm a Hillary supporter. But establishment politicians, and I'll include myself because I've been around, who ignores this movement on the left and the right will do so at great risk to their own political futures.
This is why I'm saying we are headed for probably the most exciting. Has anybody at this table seen a political season anywhere near as exciting as this? I sure haven't.
Only at the movies.
Look, we are out of time for Political Rewind this week. Greg Bluestein, Michael Thurman, Loretta Lepore, Liz Flowers, Jim Galloway. What a great pleasure to have you all here. And you really kicked off our New Year's with, I thought, a really wonderful conversation. So let me just remind you, we will be back with you next Wednesday afternoon here at GPB Radio at 2 p.m. with another live show, and then back again at our regular 3 p.m. time on Friday. I hope you start making it a regular habit to tune into both editions of Political Rewind. Also want to remind you that if you can't hear our show live, just download the GPB Atlanta app for your mobile device. You'll be able to listen to Political Rewind there, my other show, Two-Way Street, On Second Thought with Celeste Headlee, and all your favorite NPR shows. So it's a great way to keep up with us, even if you can't be by the radio when we're on the air. That's it for today from us. I'm Bill Nigut. Thank you so much for listening today. I hope to see you throughout the 2016 election cycle. All Things Considered is coming up in just a few minutes. So we'll see you again next Wednesday at 2 p.m. Thank you, Jonathan Reedy, producer, and Daryl Welch. Welcome as our new booking and research assistant. See you next time.